Breakthrough.
You are now listening to Breakthrough News. It's 5 p.m. You're listening to Breakthrough News, and this is The Punch Out. We're following the news all day so you don't have to, giving you everything you need to know about what's in the headlines and what should be. And yes, we are back here on The Punch Out, 20th of September, 2021. Very happy to be back with you here on the show. Got plenty for you here on the show, as we always do. We're going to be talking about the CELAC Summit that happened in Mexico over the weekend. We're also going to be talking a little bit about the issues around UN aid trucks in Ethiopia. But before we get to either of those two important stories, we want to start with the new U.S. sanctions regime being proposed by the Biden administration as it concerns the Horn of Africa. Well, on September 17th, the United States announced that it was creating a new sanctions regime aimed at the governments of Ethiopia and Eritrea, the regional government of Amhara, and allegedly the Tigrayan People's Liberation Front as well, all parties to the ongoing conflict in northern Ethiopia. The sanctions regime does not include new sanctions just yet, but sets up the framework for implementing them, something widely expected to take place fairly soon given the contours of the conflict. The U.S. actions are allegedly designed to bring all sides to the table for a negotiated solution, and the possible sanctions are being justified on the basis of alleged human rights abuses. At the outset, it's important to note here that any sanctions from the U.S., which would be unilateral and thus illegal under international law, are on top of that justified on the basis of extreme hypocrisy. Who gives the U.S. the right to sanction anyone on the basis of moral values? All around the world right now, the U.S. is openly backing all sorts of forces accused more or less of the same sorts of abuses. But the apartheid policies of Israel, including the brutal massacres of Palestinians, elicit no sanctions on Israel. The world's worst humanitarian crisis in Yemen being caused by U.S. partners in Saudi Arabia in conjunction with the U.S. and the U.K., and yet no sanctions leveled on Riyadh. Colombia has institutionalized the murder of social activists, but no U.S. sanctions on them either. India, one of the U.S.'s closest allies, but waging a massive crackdown on the media, brutally occupying Kashmir, and normalizing rank thuggery by the ruling party's supporters. Yet New Delhi continues to occupy pride of place in the U.S. foreign policy firmament and, of course, faces no sanctions for any of its actions. And that's not to mention the U.S. itself. Murdering families in drone strikes, putting the largest number of people in prison in the world, and a country where the police conduct over 1,000 extrajudicial killings of citizens a year. But who can sanction the U.S.? Ultimately, human rights, like any other massive globe-spanning challenge, is only going to be addressed through a collective framework, not on the backs of U.S. military and economic power, determining who gets punished and who doesn't for breaking the quote-unquote rules as unilaterally determined by the U.S. elite. From that perspective alone, this sort of diplomacy by sanctions the U.S. is engaging in the Horn of Africa is wrong and only builds on the same exact type of actions that have created some of the world's worst humanitarian crises stretching from Libya to Afghanistan. The White House statement is crafted to appear even-handed towards all sides, but a closer reading reveals that there's a thumb on the scale here. On the sanctions end, it's clear that Ethiopia and Eritrea face more pressure because they're holders of state power as opposed to the Tigrayan People's Liberation Front. They are also more vulnerable to the repercussions in the international marketplace. Now, of course, the United States is claiming that these will just be targeted sanctions that won't hurt anyone but a few high officials. But, of course, they always say that. The fact of the matter is, the more high-ranking officials on OFAC lists that may be involved in some deal in some sector, especially in countries like Ethiopia and Eritrea where the public sector plays a large role, it ultimately cools transactions of all kinds as companies and organizations decide they don't want to risk it. It's exactly these kind of policies that have helped hobble countries like Venezuela in transactions for medicines and food. In Ethiopia's case, this sanctions announcement must be also seen in the light of recent U.S. statements that they may also remove Ethiopia from the key U.S.-Africa Free Trade Agreement, AGOA, which would certainly have an economic impact. So as always, the growth of a sanctioned regime is likely to rebound against the peoples of Ethiopia and Eritrea, despite the appearances of just targeting the bold-faced names. And of course, the Tigrayan People's Liberation Front, as a non-state actor, is going to be already engaging internationally in a realm that's of murky legality and thus less subject to the pressures applied in the quote-unquote official course of transactions and deals. So in a way, partially shielded, or at least disproportionately less impacted than Ethiopia and Eritrea in terms of how this is structured. I mean, perhaps the greatest indicator of how these U.S. measures should be seen is the reaction of the various parties. The TPLF welcomed the U.S. decision, while Ethiopia and Eritrea rejected it out of hand. They welcome it, that is, the TPLF, clearly, given the way the U.S. sanctions are designed to compel Ethiopia and Eritrea to make large concessions to them, even to just start the negotiations. And when you look at the TPLF negotiating position, you see that's pretty much the only way it could go, at least if they're going to participate, which they must. They are essentially pursuing two broad goals here. Total control over Tigray, as they define, which means a significant chunk of what is today's Amhara state, removing the government of the country and replacing it with a transitional one. And maybe you could just sum these two things up by saying they want to move into reverse the process that saw them sidelined from power starting in 2018. Which is critical context. The TPLF ruled Ethiopia for 30 years. They did so with a widespread reputation for corruption, the rigging of elections, and just the type of human rights abuses the TPLF is decrying now. After pressure from popular protests, they were ultimately sidelined within their own ruling coalition. Abiy Ahmed was able to come to power, and the pace of reforms that he instituted certainly alienated the TPLF. Tens of thousands of political prisoners they put in jail were released and brought back from exile. And many of the armed groups that they had waged war against returned to the country to participate in a broader national reconciliation process. And a historic peace deal was signed with Eritrea, with whom the TPLF-led government in Ethiopia had also waged war. So ultimately, the TPLF decided to launch a war to secure by force of arms a stronger position in the political disposition of the country. When given a chance to step back from the brink, when the government declared a unilateral ceasefire, they instead escalated the war and deepened the humanitarian crisis and have spurned African Union mediation and instead backed U.S.-led talks, something the U.S. has been offering since March. TPLF leaders clearly want the U.S. at the helm, or at least in a major role, because they have failed to gain support in African forums where their framing of the conflict has not been accepted and are obviously expecting the United States to look more favorably on their side of the conflict. And all that being said, it's not as if the African forums have been 100% neutral. They have asked the Ethiopian government to make concessions to the TPLF, while they've done things the TPLF didn't like as well. But in a way, that is immaterial because the overall negotiating scene in Africa and on the continent is scattered and halting, as opinion is clearly divided amongst the various countries. The IGAD, which is a group of regional states, essentially endorsed the conflict in the 2020 summit meeting that they had on this issue. But its chair, Abdullah Hamdok, who's the head of Sudan, has also been involved in both military and political conflict with Ethiopia for most of this year. The AU has mainly limited itself to shuttle diplomacy-style talks about talks, and the new A3+1, that's Kenya, Niger, and Tunisia, the African members of the Security Council and the Progressive Alba Nation of St. Vincent and the Grenadines, seems mainly focused on preventing the AU process being overtaken by a U.S.-dominated process through the auspices of the United Nations. In the past month, Abiy Ahmed has met with the presidents of Ghana, Senegal, Rwanda, Uganda, South Sudan, and Morocco and Algeria have sent state-led investment teams to Ethiopia, all signs of at least relative support. So as you can see there, there isn't one clear African approach, quote-unquote, that's been able to get both sides on board. And when you put all this together, it just leaves the Horn of Africa in a very precarious position. With the rainy season set to end soon and the possibility for more conflict, the situation remains dire. But one thing is clear, and that's that a new U.S. sanctions regime on Ethiopia and Eritrea will produce nothing in the realm of peace building. In fact, it hands the power to the United States to determine the facts on the ground and the terms of debate, which is why the outcome here is a crucial element in the shape of the contours of the global relationship of forces. Will there be a U.S.-imposed solution in the Horn of Africa, or will Ethiopia and Eritrea stand against just that, mark yet another notch in the decline of U.S. imperial power? Well, one brief related note we didn't want to leave unsaid here as it concerns Ethiopia is the controversy ignited at the end of last week by the United Nations when it released a tweet from its Ethiopia office declaring, quote-unquote, concern, or rather that it was concerning, that a large number of aid trucks sent into Tigray had not returned. The UN accusation was quite notable, given that it lent significant credence to Ethiopian government statements that they suspected the TPLF was hijacking UN aid trucks to use for military logistics. And the tweet also seemed worded in a way to suggest that they were, in fact, tacitly supporting those government suspicions. Now, of course, since the issue lent credence to an Ethiopian government claim, it did not become a big topic of discussion in the mainstream media as it regards the conflict, and thus hasn't received much scrutiny. The TPLF denied that they have been seizing trucks. They say that the drivers just aren't returning because they don't want to be harassed at checkpoints and that there's a lack of fuel. The fuel issue in particular has become a topic of discussion online. One thing is true, UN bodies of all types have been consistent in saying there is a need for fuel. But when you look at the recent update on Ethiopia from the UNOCHA, that's the Office of Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs, you can see the statistics that must have prompted that tweet from the UN in Ethiopia. The report notes that as of September 1, they had 12% of their fuel capacity, but they noted that that was 50 days worth of fuel for their food distribution program. They also noted that they had 0 days worth of trucks left for the same program. The implication being on September 17th, it wasn't that they couldn't fuel the trucks or get some in, but that they just were not there, at least not in large enough numbers. While that's not definitive proof, it does speak to the reality of the narrative war in this conflict. Claims of atrocities by Ethiopian or Eritrean forces can skyrocket onto the front pages, even if totally tenuous. But anything suggesting bad behavior by the TPLF is pushed to the sidelines and barely investigated, and they most certainly are never framed as the aggressors, despite starting and escalating the war. Well, over the weekend in Mexico City, the Community of Latin American Caribbean States, also known as CELAC, met for the sixth time since it was formed in 2011. The Mexico City Summit marked the return of CELAC to the world stage after divisions in Latin America undermined the forum. CELAC was originally conceived as a forum for bringing together Latin American nations, both economically, culturally, and politically. It was conceived as part of the left-leaning tide in Latin America that at that time also included Brazil, and as a move towards deeper economic integration on the continent. Mexico has sought to revive the forum as essentially a counterweight to the OAS, which has pursued a divisive agenda in line with the regime change goals of the West and the continental right wing to undermine the governments of Venezuela and Bolivia, the sovereignty of Haiti, and the integrity of the electoral process in Ecuador, to just name a few of its misdeeds. Unsurprisingly, then, there were some boycotts of the CELAC meeting by major leaders of the continental right like Iván Duque, but the turnout ended up being overwhelmingly broad, with most of Latin America represented, including leaders of the left like Nicolas Maduro of Venezuela and President Díaz-Canel of Cuba, and the right like Guillermo Lasso of Ecuador and Juan Orlando Hernández of Honduras. Despite some negative comments by Uruguay about Cuba, the meeting approved a resolution to end the U.S. blockade against Cuba, gave recognition to the Cuban COVID vaccines, and reaffirmed the principles of the U.N. Charter, which is a major theme propounded by countries like Venezuela and China when decrying the unilateral sanctioned regimes of the United States. The summit also approved the creation of a regional health regulatory agency and declared the highest political commitment to combating climate change and promoting sustainable development. The summit was really most notable for the large stage it gave to Latin America's left-wing leaders, all of whom have faced attempts to overthrow and isolate political projects that they represent. It reflected that those attempts have failed, and that whatever else lies ahead, the leftward movement in Latin America that began at the end of last century can't just be snuffed out and continues to move forward here in the 21st century. That's the punch out for today. We're with you Monday through Friday, 5 p.m. here in New York East Coast Standard Time, 2 p.m. in Los Angeles Pacific Standard Time, and 9 p.m. GMT. And of course, you can support everything we do here at Breakthrough News at patreon.com/breakthroughnews. It's your patronage that keeps all of our offerings here at Breakthrough News moving forward. And of course, you can check us out across all your social media platforms, Instagram, Twitter, Facebook, at BT Newsroom.